Hello, and welcome to Plutarch's Greeks and Romans, a podcast taking you on a tour through ancient Greek and Roman history, seen through the lives of the most famous and influential people who lived it, with the ancient historian and biographer Plutarch as our guide and companion. Welcome, everyone, to part two of the lives of Themistocles and Aristides. I'm Ryan Greenwood, along with my partner in podcasting, Chris Finchie.
How's it going, everybody?
So, Chris, if you remember at the end of the last episode, Athens had just won a surprising and momentous victory over the Persian army at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC, less than 20 years after becoming the world's first democracy.
Oh, I certainly do, and I imagine it must have been very exciting times.
Yeah, it's safe to say that following the victory at Marathon, the people of Athens were feeling pretty good about themselves. Everyone except Themistocles, that is. It seems that partly this was down to jealousy of the general Miltiades, whose bold leadership at Marathon now made him Athens' top star. Themistocles needn't have been jealous, though. For the very next year, Miltiades would, apparently due to a personal grudge, convince Athens to let him lead an expedition against the island of Paros, which would end in failure. Upon his return to Athens, Miltiades was brought up on charges of treason and died in prison, probably from a gangrenous wound. It's worth taking note of the rapid rise and fall of Miltiades, because he will certainly not be the last person to discover this unfortunate feature of Athenian democracy. You can be a hero one minute and a zero the next. Of course, in the weeks following the Battle of Marathon, nobody knew that a year later their hero Miltiades would die in disgrace. And when young Themistocles' friends noticed he was not showing up at any of his usual hangouts, Plutarch says that they asked him what was troubling him, and he responded that the trophy of Miltiades would not let him sleep. This comment is in reference to the ancient Greek tradition of the victorious side in a battle erecting a trophy on the battlefield, assembled from the defeated enemy's arms and armor.
So Themistocles just couldn't stand someone else getting all the glory, eh? Sounds like a running feature in the lives of the Greeks and Romans.
Very true. But it seems that wasn't the only reason Themistocles refused to feel satisfied with the victory. Plutarch writes that when others were of opinion that the Battle of Marathon would be an end to the war, Themistocles thought that it was but the beginning of far greater conflicts. And for these, to the benefit of all Greece, he kept himself in continual readiness and his city in proper training. Now, as it happens, when word of his army's defeat at Marathon got back to the great King Darius, he was furious and determined to launch another expedition against Greece. But while preparations were underway, a revolt broke out in the crucial province of Egypt, which ended up buying Greece a little time. Before Darius would set out on campaign in Egypt, he needed to choose an heir, according to Persian tradition. Darius had a choice between his two eldest sons, born of different mothers. Artabazanes was the eldest, but Xerxes' mother was the formidable Atossa, the daughter of Cyrus the Great, and second only to Darius himself in power and influence at the Persian court. Darius wisely chose Atossa's son, Xerxes, as his heir, despite him not being the oldest son. As it turned out, Darius died before the campaign in Egypt could commence, and it fell to the new great king Xerxes to quell the rebellion. Back in Athens, Themistocles saw an opportunity to build up his city's defenses against the Persian invasion, which his foresight told him would be coming. A silver strike was made at the mines of Laurium outside Athens, and the money from this windfall was to be divided amongst the Athenian population. But Themistocles proposed that instead of a handout of 10 drachmas to every Athenian, the revenue from the mines should be spent on constructing a fleet of warships. Plutarch says 100 warships. Herodotus says 200, so maybe we'll split the difference and go with 150. Themistocles hoped this fleet could defend Athens against the Persian threat, but this is not how he pitched the idea. He knew that the Persian threat seemed far away to his fellow Athenians, so he proposed building the fleet to make war against Athens' old rival, the Aeginetans. Aegina was an island close to Athens, and the Aeginetans had a fleet of their own. Themistocles knew the Athenian people were far more likely to support building a fleet to take the fight to Aegina than to defend against Persians who, even after Marathon, seemed a distant and uncertain threat.
So appealing to jealousy and anger of the Athenians seemed like a better bet to Themistocles than appealing to their logic, maybe?
Yeah, it seems that way. We'll never know what would have happened if he had made the argument stating his real reasons, but we do know that the idea was accepted and the fleet was built, ostensibly to fight the Aeginetans, though it was never used for this purpose. The fleet that Athens built consisted of triremes, the latest in naval technology at the time. These ships were propelled by three staggered banks of oars. They were long, about 130 feet, lay relatively low in the water, and were fitted with a bronze ram in front. Some have described these ships as being like a guided missile, as the principal offensive maneuver was to propel the trireme at considerable speed into an enemy ship, the bronze ram smashing through its hull below the waterline. Plutarch says that with the construction of the fleet, Themistocles began a process of, quote, little by little, turning and drawing the city down towards the sea, in the belief that, whereas by land they were not a fit match for their next neighbors, with their ships they might be able to repel the Persians and command Greece. Thus, as Plato says, from steady soldiers he turned them into mariners and seamen, tossed about the sea, and gave occasion for the reproach against him, that he took away from the Athenians the spear and the shield, and bound them to the bench and the oar. Obviously, there would be political implications to the rising importance of the bench and the oar. Traditionally, when it came to the military, the aristocrats had supplied the cavalry. Hoplites were a mix of the upper and middle classes, but rowers, these would be made up of lower-class Athenians. Each trireme had a crew of around 200, 170 of these being rowers. Each of these rowers would receive a solid wage, training, and the confidence and political clout that came with being part of Athens' glorious new fleet. Naturally, as the mind behind the new fleet, Themistocles had become the political champion of these newly empowered lower-class Athenians. And perhaps just as naturally, his old rival Aristides would become a leader in the opposing conservative faction. Aristides had developed such a reputation for honesty and fairness by this point that some people came to him privately to settle their disputes, rather than the law courts, and some began calling him Aristides the Just. However, Themistocles began putting it about that Aristides was taking the law into his own hands, and setting himself up as a king. Now, there was an interesting feature in Athenian democracy at this time called ostracism. Each year at a certain time, the assembly would hold a vote as to whether to conduct an ostracism. If the assembly voted yes, a date was set for the ostracism vote. Citizens would write the name of the person they wished to be ostracized on an ostraca, a shard of pottery. If any one name reached a certain threshold of votes, that person would be exiled from Athens for 10 years, though their property and citizenship status would remain intact. It is said that during an ostracism vote, Aristides came upon an illiterate man struggling to write a name on his ostraca, and seeing Aristides and supposing him to be just another citizen, asked him to help him write the name Aristides on it. Plutarch writes that Aristides was surprised by this and asked the man if Aristides had ever done him any injury, and the man replied, none at all, but I am tired of hearing him everywhere called Aristides the Just. Aristides, hearing this, is said to have made no reply, but returned the sherd with his own name inscribed on it.
Wow, I guess he really was honest, eh?
Yeah, but it seems that perhaps the stories Themistocles was spreading about him had damaged his reputation. Or maybe, as Plutarch suggests, a lot of Athenians were just jealous, because Aristides ended up losing the ostracism vote and being exiled from Athens. Now, in the Persian Empire, Xerxes had squashed the rebellion in Egypt and had decided to now invade Greece. Herodotus dramatizes this decision, with Xerxes and his advisors engaging in a lot of debate, interpretation of dreams, and indecision before Xerxes ultimately decides, sometime around 484 or perhaps 483 BC, to finish what his father Darius had started and conquer Greece. This invasion would be on a significantly larger scale than the previous attempt, with a massive land army supported by an equally massive naval escort. And the preparations involved two very impressive feats of engineering. You may recall that the very first attempted invasion of Greece was scuppered when the Persian fleet encountered fierce storms in the waters off Mount Athos. To avoid that problem this time around, Xerxes had a canal dug across the width of the peninsula connecting Mount Athos to the mainland, so his ships could avoid those dangerous waters entirely. Perhaps more impressive, to convey his army across the strait which separates Asia from Europe, known as the Hellespont, Xerxes had Phoenician and Egyptian engineers construct a double pontoon bridge of boats, more than 2 kilometers long, across a strait that was known for its dangerous currents and winds. Due to these grand projects and the large army being assembled, the various poleis of Greece had a considerable amount of time to consider whether to resist or surrender. Xerxes sent messengers to all of the Greek cities demanding tokens of submission, earth and water, but not to Athens and Sparta, as they had killed the messengers sent earlier by Darius. And yes, as the movie 300 depicts in highly dramatic fashion, The messenger sent to Sparta was cast into a pit and told he could find earth and water there. However, unlike in the movie, the Spartans later regretted this decision and sent two volunteers to the court of Xerxes in Susa to sacrifice their own lives to make up for the murder of the heralds, which went against all laws of hospitality. Their mission was a pretty big failure, however. First, they refused to bow down before the king, as Persian custom demanded. As to the Greeks, only gods deserve such treatment. Second, Xerxes was not about to accept their offer and have the two Spartans killed. Herodotus quotes Xerxes as saying, "What you did, after all, when you murdered the heralds, was to contravene universal human law. I will not repeat the very deed for which I am condemning you, nor will I absolve the Lacedaemonians of their guilt by killing you in exchange."
You know, Ryan, while you were explaining the engineering feats, it got me thinking how tough both those tasks would be today using modern construction techniques. And they were doing this over 2,000 years ago within a very short space of time.
Yeah.
And also that bit on the Spartans regretting their decision to send the Persian messengers to their deaths and sending an apology really, really hurts my image of that movie. I mean, Xerxes must have seen that as a form of weakness, further emboldening the Persian king.
Yeah, well, it's far from the only problem with that movie, but I guess the one thing they did get right is the heralds were murdered.
That's true, yeah. And hey, it was a great freaking movie, right?
In any event, unlike Athens and Sparta, there were many Greek cities that would go over to the Persian side, or as the Greeks called it, Medizing. Many, but not all of these, were the states in northern Greece, like Thessaly, which would be the first in the path of the oncoming army, and stood no chance of resisting alone. The Greek states who would resist sent delegates to a conference at the Isthmus of Corinth in 481, where they formed what historians have dubbed the Hellenic League, and elected the Spartans to be the leaders of the joint forces. Such was the fighting prowess of the Spartans that they were given leadership at land and at sea, despite the fact that they were in no way a naval power. These Greek states attempted to put aside their old feuds, and so Athens would work alongside Aegina, the island that they had originally intended their fleet to fight against.
Okay, so Themistocles was right then, and likely his preparations were extremely timely.
Yeah, definitely. The peacemaking wasn't always successful, though. The polis of Argos, long a bitter enemy of Sparta, refused to serve in any coalition led by the Lacedaemonians, and so remained neutral. Now, at some point in all of this, Herodotus tells us that the Athenians consulted the oracle at Delphi, as it seems likely most cities did prior to the Persian invasion. Herodotus says that, and I'm paraphrasing a little here, the Athenians had sent emissaries to the god at Delphi, and these were sitting down to make their consultation when the Pythia began to declaim an oracle. "Why are you sitting there, you fools? Leave! Flee to the ends of the earth. Abandon your homes and the towering heights that ring your city. Everything is doomed. Everything brought crashing to the ground by flames and passion-filled Ares as he lashes on Syrian-bred steeds. Go, leave my sanctum. Shroud your spirits beneath the pall of your woes."
Wow, that's pretty dark.
Yeah. Needless to say, the Athenians were not encouraged by this oracle and were hesitant to go back to Athens bearing such a dire prophecy. It was then that a local man named Timon, highly respected at Delphi, suggested that they pick up some olive tree boughs and go back into the temple as suppliants and beg for a more favorable oracle from the Pythia. They took this advice and received this slightly more hopeful oracle. "While everywhere else will fall that the borders of Cecrops land contain, yes, and the ravines of most holy Kithaeron as well, yet to Tritigenea far-seeing Zeus grants a wooden wall, yet only this will stand defiant, a succor to you and your children. Do not then abide the coming of the cavalry nor the foot. Still in the face of the vast landslide host, you must retreat instead, and turn your backs. And yet for all that, you shall meet them face to face. Divine Salamis, the sons of women will be destroyed by you, when the grain is scattered, or else when the harvest is gathered in." Now this oracle, which still mentions retreat and destruction, also mentions a wooden wall that will stand. But there was much debate back in Athens about what this meant. Some thought that the wooden wall referred to the ancient hedge which ringed the Acropolis in ancient times, and so the Athenians must make a stand atop the Acropolis. Others thought that the wooden wall referred to their fleet of wooden ships, though some argued this could not be the case because the line, "Divine Salamis, the sons of women will be destroyed by you," seemed to promise destruction if the fleet fought in the straits between the mainland and the nearby island of Salamis. Into this debate waded Themistocles, who explained that the wooden wall did indicate the fleet, and the prophecy did not promise defeat at sea, or else the Pythia would have used the words "cruel Salamis" or the like, instead of "divine Salamis." The people unsurprisingly latched onto this explanation because it gave them hope. In 480 BC, the Persian army crossed the pontoon bridge over the Hellespont and slowly marched through Thrace towards Greece. In the region of Doriscus in Thrace, Xerxes halted the army and the supporting fleet and conducted a review of his troops. This provides Herodotus the opportunity to describe, one by one, the many different peoples which made up Xerxes' vast army, in a manner reminiscent of Homer's catalogue of the ships in the Iliad. Persians, Medes, Assyrians, Bactrians, Phrygians, Lydians, Ethiopians, Arabians. I simply don't have the stamina to go through the full list. It may seem odd that the makeup of the army would be so geographically diverse, but the fact that Xerxes himself was leading the army might explain this. The core of the army was the 10,000-strong Persian immortals, who functioned as a royal bodyguard. The Persian fleet was also multi-ethnic, the largest contributors being the Phoenicians and Xerxes' subject Greek cities, followed by the Egyptians. Herodotus says that the best ships were provided by the Phoenician cities, best of all from the city of Sidon. Herodotus also praises the 5 warships provided and led in person by the woman Artemisia, who was from Halicarnassus, the same city Herodotus hailed from. Herodotus writes, "Following the death of her husband, she had taken over the reins of power, and although she had a grown son, and although there was not the slightest pressure upon her to join the campaign, she was prompted to do so by the formidable masculine cast of her bravery." Herodotus actually uses the word Andrea here, which is usually translated literally as manliness. Herodotus goes on to say that there was no other squadron in the entire fleet more highly esteemed than hers, nor any other ally who gave the king better advice than she. During the advance of Xerxes' army, Herodotus highlights several incidents which serve to paint Xerxes as the sort of stereotypical Asian despot, whipping and frightening his slavish subjects. But one definitely wonders whether these are true representations of Xerxes' character, or perhaps more so just included to show what was at stake for the Greeks if they lost, and play up the whole freedom versus slavery aspect of the war.
That seems quite possible. Herodotus definitely seems to know how to tell a story to maximum effect.
Yeah, he certainly does. So, I will skip over these anecdotes, but I will mention the burden Xerxes apparently placed on the Greeks that hosted his army along its march into Greece. This was an army so large it was claimed to have drunk rivers dry, and the Persian king always traveled in style. Wherever the army camped, a massive pavilion would be pitched for the king and his guests to eat a lavish dinner supplied by their local hosts. Herodotus says that these hosts were reduced to such desperate straits by the cost of these banquets, it cost them their homes. It is said that one witty man in Abdera said that the Abderites should all go to the temple and give thanks to the gods that Xerxes was only in the habit of taking one meal a day. After all, if they had to prepare a breakfast on the scale of the dinner, they would have had to flee the city when they saw Xerxes approach.
Well, at least he had a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah. Now, the allied Greek forces at first planned to make a stand at the Vale of Tempe, which guarded the route into Thessaly. But upon discovering that this position could be turned, they decided instead to make their stand further south at the Hot Gates, Thermopylae. At sea, they would make a stand nearby at Artemisium, a narrow strait separating the mainland from the island of Evia, where the fleet could be in close communication with the land forces. The problem, though, is that only an advance guard of Greek defenders was sent to Thermopylae. It seems that the Greek cities were perhaps intimidated and needed a display of leadership from the Spartans, who were once again being held back from marching to war by a religious festival, the Carnia. The excuse for the rest of Greece holding back was the Olympic truce that was traditionally observed during the Olympic Games. So King Leonidas of Sparta took a force of 300 to Thermopylae, which prompted other Greek allies to commit smallish contingents of their own to help guard the pass. All told, there were maybe 5,000 Greeks led by King Leonidas and his 300 Spartans, up against the massive army of Xerxes. How massive? Certainly not 1,700,000 strong, as Herodotus reports. Modern historical estimates seem to fall more into the 100,000 to 150,000 area. The Persians had overwhelming numerical superiority, no matter how you look at it. Now, as I mentioned previously in the life of Lycurgus, the Spartans, who spent much of their lives training for war, liked to relax a little bit before an actual battle. So when a Persian scout came upon the Spartans at Thermopylae, he found some of them combing out their long hair. You'll remember, adult male Spartans grew their hair long, unlike other Greek men. The other Spartans the Persian scout observed were exercising, in the nude, of course, which was common practice for all Greek men when exercising. When Xerxes got word of these renowned Spartans exercising in the nude and combing their hair, it seems he didn't know what to make of it, but suffice it to say, he probably wasn't expecting what came next. It was mid-August at this point, and it was surely hot. The Greeks held a very narrow pass between the sea and the mountains, which, due to changes in topography, is actually now a 5-kilometer plain. At the time, though, it was so narrow in parts that apparently two wagons could hardly pass each other. On the first day, they stood tenaciously against the onslaught of the invading army, with the Persians unable to make their numbers count in the narrow confines of the pass. The defenders fought in relays to stay fresh. The highly trained Spartans are said to have pulled off a number of false retreats, causing the enemy to pursue them in a disorganized manner, before the Spartans wheeled about as one and began mowing down the surprised enemy. Toward the end of the day, Xerxes sent in his immortals, but even they were unable to force their way through. It is said that Xerxes leapt up from his throne 3 times in alarm at his losses.
His throne?
Yeah, it seems that he was watching the battle from a throne he brought along with him. There are other accounts of Persian kings participating in battles, but not this time. Although, this fight for the pass may not have seemed like a true battle to him. Anyway, the second day went on the same way as the first, but then we are told that a traitorous Greek by the name of Epialtes informed the Persians of a narrow path through the mountains, which could be used to outflank the Greeks. The Greeks were aware of the path, and Leonidas had sent Phocian allies to defend it, but they were caught by surprise when the Persians ascended the path in the night, and the Phocians were scattered. That was the beginning of the end for the Greek defenders. Leonidas dispersed the allies, or they just left, except for the 700 Thespians who chose to stay with the Spartan 300, and 400 Thebans who were pretty much hostages brought along to make sure Thebes didn't go over to the Persians. The fighting was fierce that final day, and when King Leonidas fell, the contest over his body was intense. The possession of Leonidas' body changed multiple times, and 2 brothers of Xerxes apparently died in the brawl. In the end, though, the last Spartans died and the Persians made it through the hot gates. Meanwhile, the Greek fleet had been attempting to hold the Straits of Artemisium. Themistocles was there with the Athenian ships, and Plutarch says that he apparently had to make a show of ceding command to the Spartan commander Eurybiades so that his Athenian sailors would obey him. The fleet held back 2 attempts by the Persian armada to force the straits, and this, along with a summer storm which battered the exposed enemy ships, inflicted significant losses on the Persians. However, when word came of the defeat at Thermopylae, the Greek fleet had to withdraw. Now with the Persians fast approaching, Themistocles urged Athens to repeal all banishments, chiefly the banishment of Aristides. Themistocles could see that the Athenians wanted him back, and also feared that if Aristides went over to the Persian side, he might draw many Athenians with him. Aristides returned ready to put old differences aside for the greater good. Plutarch quotes Aristides as saying, "Themistocles, laying aside at this time our vain and childish contention, let us enter upon a safe and honorable dispute, vying with each other for the preservation of Greece." And Aristides supported Themistocles' notion that the Athenians should now flee the city and take to the ships to fight a battle in the Straits of Salamis. However, it was a tough sell to convince many Athenians to abandon the city. Plutarch says that some felt that if they left, it would signify little to gain a victory, and that there could be no deliverance any longer after they had once forsaken the temples of their gods and exposed the tombs and monuments of their ancestors to the fury of their enemies. The bulk of the Athenians did flee, though. The elderly women and children were transported to the islands of Aegina and Salamis, and across the Saronic Gulf to Troezen. Plutarch says that the bulk went to Troezen and were relocated with goodwill, and says that, quote, "When the whole city of Athens were going on board, it afforded a spectacle worthy of pity alike and admiration, to see them thus send away their fathers and children before them, and unmoved with their cries and tears, pass over into the island. But that which stirred compassion most of all was that many old men, by reason of their great age, were left behind, and even the tame domestic animals could not be seen without some pity, running around the town and howling, as desirous to be carried along with their masters that had kept them. Among which it is reported that Xanthippus, the father of Pericles, had a dog that would not endure to stay behind, but leaped into the sea, and swam along by the galley's side till he came to the island of Salamis, where he fainted away and died. And that spot in the island, which is still called the dog's grave, is said to be his."
Man's best friend.
Yeah, I can't believe they kind of just watched the dog swimming alongside the ship and didn't pick him up or anything. But anyway, yeah, good story. A few nuts stayed behind in Athens and fortified the Acropolis, still thinking that the wooden wall and the oracle was a hedge, but they were overcome and killed when the Persians arrived to sack and burn the city. With the people evacuated and the city destroyed, the challenge for Themistocles was to convince the allied fleet to stay together and fight with them against the Persian fleet in the Straits of Salamis. It seems that many of the allies were considering abandoning Athens. From their perspective, the Athenians may have seemed like a lost cause. Their city had been burnt, and the Persian fleet was at least double the size of the allied Greek fleet. That being said, the Athenians had some 180 ships and made up a good half of the Greek fleet. If the Athenians were to give up and go over to the Persian side, then Sparta and her remaining allies would be extremely hard-pressed to hold out for long. And Themistocles more or less threatened to do just that if the other Greek cities were to abandon them now.
Nothing like the threat of mutual destruction to bring people together.
Exactly. So the Greek fleet stayed together and resolved to battle it out with the Persians in the narrow Straits of Salamis, where the Persians would not be able to overwhelm them with their numbers. From the perspective of Xerxes, he just didn't want the Greeks to get away and sacrifice the advantage of fighting in more open waters so that he could crush the Greeks in this decisive battle. Things had been going pretty well so far. Sure, he had been stalled momentarily at Thermopylae and Artemisium, but in a few days that resistance had been swept away, and his army had then swept through northern and central Greece and burned the stubborn city of Athens, whose people had inflicted a setback on his father Darius at Marathon 10 years earlier. With a decisive naval victory here, the war would likely be all but won. And so the Persian fleet moved into the narrow straits, and one of the first major naval battles in history was waged. The Greeks are said to have fought it in a disciplined manner, while the Persian fleet became disorganized. It also seems that the Persian ships were larger and less maneuverable than the Greeks, or perhaps were loaded down with more marines than the Greek ships, their aim being to board the enemy ships and make it into more of a land battle at sea. A force of Persians was garrisoned on a small island in the strait, and while the sea battle raged, Aristides led a small force of Athenian hoplites from Salamis over to the island on small boats and slaughtered the Persian forces there. Eventually, the Persian side collapsed after losing many ships and began a retreat. It is said that the fierce Artemisia of Halicarnassus sunk a ship from her own side which got in the way of her retreat. Xerxes was furious at the defeat and contemplated ways of salvaging the situation. However, he was apparently concerned that the Greeks would use their newfound naval advantage to sail to the Hellespont and destroy Xerxes' bridge of boats, trapping him in Europe. So Xerxes departed back to Persia and left the core of his army in the command of his general Mardonius to hopefully win the war in his absence. In theory, the army left in Mardonius's command should be more than large enough to take on whatever army the Greeks could field. It turned out Xerxes didn't have to worry about the Greeks taking the initiative at sea and sailing to secure the Hellespont. As we know, Themistocles had a hard enough time just convincing his allies to fight at Salamis. However, with victory at Salamis, the complexion of things had changed. It being September now, at the end of campaign season, the Persian general Mardonius withdrew his army to Viotia in central Greece to spend the winter. In the spring, things could be decided with one final land battle. However, when the two sides did meet at the following year in 479 BC, at what will become known as the Battle of Plataea, both Pausanias, the commander of the Greek allies, and the Persian general Mardonius were playing things safe, trying to draw the other side into attacking them in a favorable and well-defended position. Neither side was about to budge, and so they spent some days holding their positions. Mardonius put pressure on the Greeks with his cavalry, charging and harassing the Greeks with horse archers. He also muddied the Greek water and prevented access to supplies. He also seems to have had some hopes of sowing divisions in the Greek side. And indeed, unsurprisingly, there was some squabbling going on among the Greek allies about how to proceed and which allied contingent should hold which position on the battlefield. Throughout these petty disagreements, Plutarch reports that Aristides, who had been chosen as a general for the war by the Athenians, was a voice of reason and maturity. He was not about to allow himself or the other Athenians to be distracted from the bigger picture by perceived insults from allies. The Greeks could not hold their position forever, but neither could Mardonius. Every day more Greeks came wandering in to join the allied army, eating away at the Persians' numerical advantage. And ultimately, Mardonius did need a decisive battle to end the Greek resistance. Not to mention he also had a large army to keep supplied. Eventually, though, unhappy with their position and under constant pressure from the Persian cavalry, the Spartan commander Pausanias made the decision to pull his forces back a short distance under cover of night. However, the leader of one Spartan regiment refused to retreat from foreigners, and some allied forces became lost, either accidentally or on purpose, during the night march. In the morning, when Mardonius saw the confusion of the Greeks, and perhaps thinking that their alliance or will to fight had indeed collapsed, ordered an attack. It seems that with the different forces being spread out over a distance, now it almost became two separate battles. The Athenians squared off against the Greeks who had Medized and were fighting for the Persians, the Thebans being the largest contingent. Meanwhile, in another area of the battlefield, the Spartans and their Tegean allies were confronted by the core of the Persian army, led by their general Mardonius. The Persians advanced to within bowshot of the Spartans, set up a barrier of wicker shields, and began raining arrows down on the Spartans and Tegeans. The priests made offerings of sacrificial animals, but the omens kept proving unfavorable, and so the Spartans would not advance, but held their ground as more men kept falling beneath volleys of arrows. Eventually, the Tegeans couldn't take it anymore, and began to advance on the Persians by themselves. Plutarch says that at this moment, the Spartan commander Pausanias turned to the nearby temple of Hera at Kithaeron, with tears in his eyes, and raising his hands to heaven in prayer, begged that if it were not in the fates of the Greeks to obtain the victory, that they might not perish without performing some remarkable thing, and by their actions demonstrating to their enemies that they waged war with men of courage and soldiers. At that moment, the entrails of the sacrificial animals at last looked positive, and Pausanias gave the order to attack. The unstoppable Spartan phalanx moved forward, beating aside the wall of wicker shields, then thrusting and stabbing into the Persian ranks. The Persians did not give ground easily, though, and fought fiercely. Herodotus reports that they seized onto the longer Spartan spears with their bare hands, breaking them when they could, and forcing the Spartans to press on with their short swords. Wherever Mardonius appeared on his striking white horse, the Persians rallied to the fight, but eventually Mardonius himself fell in the fighting. The Spartans forced the Persians to retreat to some fortifications they had erected, which were eventually overcome. With the victory at the Battle of Plataea, the Persian invasion was defeated, and Greece narrowly avoided being another conquest of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. The continued existence of Athens was in large part owed to the efforts of the prescient Themistocles and his honorable rival Aristides. And while the Persian Wars represent the finest hours in the lives of Themistocles and Aristides, their stories actually do not end here. We will hear more about these two Athenians when we return to Greece for episode 10, The Life of Cimon. For now, though, we are going to step away from Greece for a moment. Next episode, we will shift our focus back to Rome, where a major shakeup will happen during the life of Publius Valerius Poplicola. As always, thanks for listening to the Plutarch's Greeks and Romans podcast. If you liked this episode, make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, check us out on Facebook, and our website, plutarchsgreeksromans.com, for maps and other info.